Hi, and welcome to the Solution Series. I'm your host, James White, and along with my co-host, Corey Lynn. And we're delighted to be here today with you on this broadcast. And what we're going to do is we know a lot about the problems that are going on. We've talked about those all the time. But what we really need to do is really need to bring forth solutions. And that really is the goal of this series. And we do appreciate you joining us today. Corey, how are you? Thanks so much for joining up with me here to do the Solution Series. It's great to have you as a co-host.
Yeah, I'm super excited. We've been planning this for a while, so we have a lot of great guests line up, and I'm ready to rock and roll and get some good solutions out to people.
Well, speaking of good guests, we have one with us today, and I'm going to start off by giving him a proper introduction, and we'll go ahead and go from there. John Kane Carter is our guest. He got a degree in geology from the University of Texas. Later, he attended the Ranch Management Program at Texas Christian University, which gave him two gifts, a Brazilian wife and a land management skills. After graduating from college, John joined the U.S. Army and served in the Long Range Surveillance Detachment, 101st Airborne Division in Desert Storm. In 1996, John and his wife moved to southern Amazon Basin in Brazil to an area in northeastern Mato Grosso State called the Valley of the Forgotten. Sounds like an interesting place. A place of no power grid, no telephone, no police, no store, no help. This reality demanded a can-do attitude and a sense of humor. John founded Alença de Terra in 2004 with the intention to install a land stewardship ethos across the Amazon frontier during its critical development stage. This land stewardship movement now includes over 2,000 farms and ranches, totaling 13 million acres of land inventoried in the Producing Right platform, which serves as a tool to incentivize excellence in land management through technical support and higher margins for its farmers and ranchers. Out of necessity, in 2009, Alença de Terra launched the first wildland firefighting unit in the Brazilian Amazon called Brigada Alença, whose mission is to do what others had failed at, control the intense fires that rage across the Amazon every dry season. The U.S. smoke jumpers and hotshots graciously provided the technical training, and the leadership training was provided by John's Army buddy, Kelly Mahone, who used his special forces skills to transform a group of individuals into a band of brothers, able and willing to lead as well as the skills necessary to force multiply across a geographic region the size of the American West. After 14 years in the field, wherever the Brigada Alença goes, uncontrolled wildfire is eliminated. John is married to a gal he sat next to at TCU's Ranch Management Program. He and Kika have two strong-willed girls named Katrina and Maria. They love God, his people, and his land. And we are just delighted to have you here today, John Kane Carter, with us. What an interesting life you've led, my friend.
It's a pleasure to be here. I really appreciate it. I feel honored. And God's graced me with fulfilling a childhood dream. So here I am.
Yeah, John and I have spent a lot of time talking, and I got to tell you, 2 hours goes by and it feels like about 5 minutes, right, John?
Yeah.
We have a lot to say. And in talking with him, you know, he's a rancher in Texas and also still has the ranches. You have two ranches, right, in the
yes.
Amazon? Yeah.
One in the Amazon, one in the southern part of the country, Brazil.
Okay. And one of the things that he's so good at is just the mentally preparing for this, you know, and the contingency plans and coming up with proper systems. And for him, it's, you're so experienced with all of this that it seems easy. And we're talking the other day and I said, you said, oh, there's nothing to worry about. I mean, this stuff's pretty easy. And I said, well, it's easy for you, but I think it's intimidating for a lot of people because it feels like a lot's being thrown at us all at once. So I think it would be great to kind of start out with mentally preparing. Like what is the, you know, in the 5-point contingency plan that you talk about?
Well, I guess, first of all, you got to kind of clear your head, quit watching television, quit reading all the garbage because it's intended to create fear, and fear is paralyzing. And the lessons that I've obtained in both the military, but most importantly in the Amazon, living in Brazil, is that nothing's impossible. If you have a plan and keep it simple, stupid, a simple plan, focus on shelter, food, water, health, and surround yourself with people who have skills that you don't, then it's kind of a fun deal. I got stuck into it by happenstance. I didn't realize what I was getting into when I moved to Brazil to the Amazon frontier in 1996. Flew an airplane, a single engine, down from Texas to the wild frontier and landed in a place that had no electricity other than a generator. Water was pumped from a spring that was dug out. Over time realized how fun it was. And so I think that's today, the look at modern America, where we're multiple generations away from the farm. The majority of Americans live in the city. And I think that's the danger. People are intimidated by this, and that it's really quite simple. The basic necessities to survive, not that hard if you can prepare yourself, Corey.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you lived there almost completely off grid for about 7 years, right?
Yeah, we lived off grid for that time. And managed the last 20 years in that type of condition. So no electricity whatsoever. We were beyond settlement, so to speak. We were 18 hours away from a hospital. Any type of civilized town other than some frontier towns. We learned to live with the bare minimum, where we would run a diesel generator 3 to 4 hours a night. We would inventory fuel that would last for roughly 2 months at a time. And we had a backup to our generator, another generator. We had solar panels that would charge batteries for our communication radios. We didn't have telephone, we used shortwave radios. So we learned how to really be like a jack of all trades. When an engine breaks down, what do you do? And those types of things are those are the things that really might intimidate people, because it's all those what ifs. But what we had was a guy that lived next door to us we were on a 22,000 acre ranch. Our neighbor's place was 130,000 acres, pretty big. And they had one man there who was kind of the manager. He managed their hydroelectric dam. They had built their own lake, built their own turbine, produced their own energy. And he was my shepherd, and he taught me a lot. And so it was really that community that made it easy, made it fun. So I think really in preparation for what is certain to come to our country, mm-hmm. is to build a community first. Or focus on community should be top on the list, and meeting people with different skill sets, different trades, electricians, mechanics, farmers. If you live outside of the city in a rural area or semi-rural, and if you don't, then you have those same people and assets inside an urban setting. The amount of land you need to grow your own garden is minimal. You don't need a whole lot of land. The most important thing is how you're going to run your generator, where you're going to get your fuel from, and what your medications. If you don't have access to a pharmacy or a doctor, what do you do? You know, we had that experience many times. We delivered babies that we didn't have time to get to the hospital, treated snake bites, broken arms, busted heads, just about everything you think of, and survived.
Right. Now, what was the herb? I know you broke your arm when you were there, and you had herbs on it, and the doctor was able to note, recognize that during the x-rays or something, right?
Yeah, I was working in the corral, and a cow had kicked in the chute and broke my forearm. And so we lived, like I said, about 18 hours away from the hospital. So I did have a bush plane. I couldn't fly because my hand is swollen up, my right hand had. So I had to wait for the swelling to go down. And in the meantime, one of my employees suggested using a plant that grew there and make a pontus, boil it, put it on almost scalding on the skin, and then wrapped it real tight. And said it helped the swelling go down and it helped also the bone heal. I didn't have a compound fracture. It wasn't displaced, it was fracture. So I did that for 2 days straight, and sure enough, the swelling went down, and by the third day I could move my fingers, and so I eventually took off in my airplane with my 2-year-old daughter in the right seat, my co-pilot in a baby chair, and flew back to civilization, went to the doctor, got an x-ray, and the doctor said, you know, your bone's discolored. And he didn't ask me what I used. He said, did you use herbicide? I said, yes, sir, I did. And he said, yeah, that's very common in the frontier. So
now what is it called? What's the herb called?
Araba meaning herb, Santa Maria, St. Mary, St. Mary's herb, and you can grow it. And so what is also interesting, Corey, is that, the living in the Amazon frontier, you have all sorts of folks that live there. You have a lot of pioneers that went there on foot that were somehow managed to get there.
Right. And
the old ones that I met back in the mid 90s, had lived for 2 decades with no electricity, nothing, built their own houses, thatch roofs. They were true pioneers, had no access to the outside world, nothing. And so every homestead is exactly the same. They plant the same plants for their pharmacy. They plant the same trees for the, you know, fruit trees. When they leave to go to town, you can always tell where those old homesteads were, because you can see the same list of 20 trees that grew there and plants. And they survived. They didn't just survive, they thrived.
Wow. So then I know you also, so you were saying that you used a generator and you would run it for like 4 hours a day. And then at one point you had, you would keep your meat frozen in a freezer. And then at one point when the freezer broke down, then what did you do with the meat?
Yeah, that's a good question. And that's, you know, probably in a lot of people's minds about generator use. And you don't think that, you just kind of think you're going to turn on and use it till the fuel goes out. Well, that's kind of stupid. If you don't need it during the day, then don't turn it on. So we wouldn't use it during the day. We'd only turn it on if we needed to use a welder or some sort of shop equipment. And then at night, we turn it on right at dark. And we would run it long enough. Over time, we figured out how many hours we needed it for our deep freeze to maintain the meat that we had frozen. We would kill 1 or 2 animals a month, a heifer or a steer, and that would be the meat supply for the entire ranch, all of our employees and ourselves. So we figured out that it was 4 hours a day turned on, and the other 20 hours turned off. But as long as we didn't open the freezer during the day, it would keep it frozen. And so that way we could ration our fuel to last for multiple months versus, you know, spending it all in a matter of weeks.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So then when the freezer broke at one point, you said you took the meat and turned it into, you made sun jerky out of it, right?
Yeah. So we lost power multiple times for whatever reason, mechanical issues, parts. And so that when that would happen by the third day, because it'll stay frozen for 2 days. And then the third day it starts to thaw out. So we would take all the meat out and cut it thin. And you go, what they do there is they don't smoke it or anything. You put it on top of a tin roof, salt it and lay it on the tin. And then in the heat of the day, just leave it there as long as you want to. It's salted, of course.
Right.
Galvanized, yeah. And then that becomes, when you do use that, you kind of soak it to get the excess salt out. And it makes it a little bit softer, and then you don't necessarily have to cook it, but you can cook it. It's already cured because of the salt.
I have a follow-up question, if I can, regarding the health medical stuff you talked about a little bit earlier. Did you have the benefit, John, of having, on my shelf, I have a book called If There Is No Doctor and If There Is No Dentist. Did you have any type of material like that? Because that would be something, you know, caught out there in a remote area like that. Again, as you said, 18 hours away from a doctor or a physician. Did you have any type of materials, or did you use customs and traditions for treatment?
No, James. When I moved down there, it was before the internet, you know, And so I went cold turkey and landed there. And then the skill sets the people had, all of our employees, all of them had grown up in the frontier, and they were, as we'd say in the Army, tough as woodpecker lips. And they had came from different angles. Some are gold miners, cowboys, you have it, and you name it. But there's what I've learned as I started to understand the language and the culture, that there is a smorgasbord of plants that everyone knew. All the, so to speak, non-Indian frontiersmen knew copaiba, whatever. I get into all the plants because they're in Portuguese, but. And then I became accustomed or acquainted with the Indians and the native tribes there. And of course their knowledge was exponentially more than the pioneers, but what the pioneers had was pretty extraordinary. And they had stuff for headaches, for stomach problems, for colds, the flu, you name it. For healing cuts. There's a tree called, like I said, copaiba. They call it the cure-all tree because they use it for multiple diseases. And then they had also types of foods you eat, what kind of soup or chicken you're going to eat to accompany a flu. And those are things were called, remind me of my grandmother from, they grew up in Appalachia. So very similar.
Wow. Okay, so let's go back to the power systems for a minute, because I know you, like on your ranch there in Texas, you have kind of several backups in place. So how do you suggest people go about having, a plan A, a plan B for when it comes to power supply?
So the power supply is not cheap. I mean, it takes an investment, and I have it priority wise with the dense fuel that's going to give me the most energy, most bang for my buck. And that of course is a diesel generator. And then you can store it, because you can store a diesel for a longer time, up to a year. You can actually put an additive in it. You can't store gasoline that long. So that's why I prefer that. And then that fuel also serves for my tractor, truck, everything else. So that's my first backup. I have a transfer switch that if the power goes off, it automatically cuts on the generator. At the same time, I do have solar panels. I do not have the batteries. I didn't invest in the batteries because they were still for normal times. And I wouldn't say we're headed into normal times, but for the past, I didn't think it was worth it. And now I'm reconsidering. So I could actually inventory energy in the batteries too. And then we have propane generator as well. I have a diesel and a propane actually. And I have propane stoves. You can have a propane refrigerator. So you can still maintain, because one important thing is psychologically, mentally, is when you've been raised with refrigeration and ice and cold food, it's kind of hard to get weaned off of it. So if you have a propane refrigerator, then it keeps it cold all day. You don't have to have the generator on, and it'll last for about, a long time. We would run just our refrigerator on full time on propane for a month in those little small cylinders. I don't know how many pounds they are. And then we would have a big inventory of kerosene lamps, candles, and we would use candles at night when the generator goes out. We would have candles next to the bed so we didn't get snake bit as we walked to our bathroom at night. Had flashlights, of course, rechargeable flashlights, shortwave radio with car batteries that would be charged with one solar panel. So it's the more the merrier, and that's what I have done here, is as much as I can is to diversify. And then what we finally did, though, to solve the problem once and for all, is we built our own lake, a big lake. It was quite big. It was about 110 acres. Wow. But then we designed, this is all out in the middle of nowhere with that community I'm talking about, a man who had an engineering mind. He didn't have an engineering degree, but he designed and built a hydroelectric turbine that would spin, you could transfer that energy into running a generator. And so we ended up producing 130 kilowatts, which was is about five or six times more than your big Generac or Briggs & Stratton generators can do.
And that
was free. And we had people come hang up the power lines. And so it's really not that hard. The hardest part, I would say, is getting over the fear and don't be a deer in the headlights. If you're concerned about the future, you're going to have power outages. I don't think we're going to lose anything in the next year or two permanently, but we'll certainly have outages. It may last a day or two or three. So it's really nothing to panic about, especially if you have a propane refrigerator or freezer, you know, and have some candles. It might be hot or might be cold, but it's not the end of the world. We would lose it at times. We lost our water source. We had a spring. We dug out a spring and improved it, meaning we dug deep, maybe 4 or 5 feet deep, and put in 50-gallon drums and perforated those drums with holes so that it would fill up with water. And then we piped that water as it collected downstream by gravity to a creek that we ended up putting a water wheel on it. And the water wheel had a pump that wouldn't pump that water a mile up to our house. And so we had continual water being pumped in the house 24 hours a day. It wasn't treated. It was just spring water. And every now and then that would stop and it would be a broken pipe over that mile long pipeline. Or one time we had an anaconda get stuck at the source, got stuck in a tube, rotted. And then we figured that out when we drank the water and almost threw up, you know.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, we dug water wells, you know, had water well, one of our place, other property, we dug a well that was, I don't know how deep, 30 feet maybe, pretty deep, maybe not that, 7-8 meters. And it was an old timey well, you know, and then bricked it and then had to crank and you just pull the bucket up. So that was our ultimate backup. And of course, we also drank out of the river, took baths in the river, in the lake. We had to.
Right.
Now, let me ask you a question, if I can. A lot of people, of course, they store food. You know, they store water filtration stuff. How important do you think the psychological, being strong psychologically is going to be, you know, if there is some breakdowns and some grid breakdowns and that type of thing, some interruptions in the food supply, some people are going to want to panic generally because some people are that way. Do you find that that is going to be one of the most important things, is being psychologically ready for what's coming?
I think that's the most important. It is the most important. And when you know that you're headed for hard times or you're going to go on a combat mission, and that anxiety, once you're in the crap, everything goes away. And then you revert to training and to, you know, to real time. So once you get into that situation, then you're there, there's no more anxiousness. So that anxiety you'll ultimately realize is kind of unnecessary. And it's very disheartening. And I mean, I think, because I listened to a lot today, and I listened to a lot, I told Corey recently, I said, you know, I got to quit listening to this, because sometimes it even tricks me and convinces me that I got to be worried. And I stop and think, I said, why? I don't have to be worried. And I have storable food, but not because I'm worried, just because I'm perhaps lazy. And I really, you know, it'd be nice to have 30 to 40 days of stored food so that I can go out there and shoot a couple dozen deer or coons or possums or squirrels or whatever, rabbits, you know, come on, not that big a deal. Foraging also, especially if you live in the Eastern United States, there's so many ways that you can sustain yourself. It's really, it's that easy, really. I mean, so many videos and so many books and so many resources. But I would say that for sure, for people that don't have any training in this or life's experiences, you definitely want to get some sort of food, whether it be storable food or macaroni or spaghetti, dried food, ramen, whatever, that's going to keep you alive. You might get sick of it after a while, but you still, I mean, just join the infantry and you'll find out about getting sick of eating MREs every day. But, you know, you got rice, beans, buying it in bulk. You can go to Costco and buy, whatever you want. And you put it in those sealed you know, little containers. And that's what I've got tons of that. Don't have to worry about it. It'll last indefinitely. So, you know, really that's what we did at our ranch is we supplied our own garden. We had a full-time gardener. We made our own fertilizer, our own manure. We cured it ourselves. And we had so much produce, we couldn't eat it all. It was impossible. And we had dozens of employees at times, depending on what our labor situation was. And we raised our own animals, had all the meat we wanted. The only thing we had to worry about buying was salt, sugar, coffee, rice, and beans. We had 100 chickens, hens. We had about 100. We had about 112 sheep that roamed, and whenever we wanted a lamb at one of our properties. So, you know, of course, that's in a ranch or farm setting, but even in a small homestead, you can do the same thing. So,
yeah, I know. Now, you've been talking a lot with me about the soil and different methods instead of using the store-bought, the bad chemicals and the bad fertilizers, and really building up the soil and working on creating a system that sort of an ecological system that feeds itself. And so tell us a little bit about what you're working on or learning there with that.
I think that's what's really the fun part is you need your short-term needs, how you're going to get over kind of a gap between normalcy to, you know, the future. And that gap is stored food, whatever, like we just talked about. But once you're into the new reality of broken, you know, supply chains and who knows what's going to happen. I mean, honestly, I don't like even worrying about it because I'm more into, I want to break away from this system regardless if things break down or not. I'm kind of fed up with the existing food system. I'm sick of the greed. I'm sick of these companies. I'm sick of their lies. I'm just sick of their lies because it's obvious what's going on. And so that spurred me on to look for alternatives and listening to friends who farm and ranch and listening to their own personal stories of transitioning away from synthetics into, and also my experience in Brazil where we didn't have fertilizer, we didn't have access to it, we're so far away. And what we did was we created a soil biology that was alive and actually the way God intended it. It was rich and fluffy. And so that produced a real healthy food. And so that healthy food changes your attitude, your mind, et cetera. And when we would come back to the States for vacation every now and then, my wife and I would comment on, hey, don't you feel different? After about a week of being back in the States, don't you feel heavy and sluggish? And we started to catch on to it. The soil part is, if you're going to go if you're going to start a garden and you need to grow food immediately and you got to use nitrogen, potassium, phosphorus, whatever, buy it from Lowe's or Home Depot, whatever, and buy all the chemicals that go on and to kill everything that have skull and crossbones on it, you're going to grow food and you could sort of use it to, you know, for a crunch period until you get firmly established. But ultimately, you're killing the soil microbiology. And so that you're sterilizing it and you get hooked in a system where you have to go back to the, you know, to the Lord's and buy from the Lord's all your inputs and you can't really get out of that system. So what we are doing, and I'm still learning, but is focusing on your soil health, feeding the soil, having cover crops, whether cool season or warm season, that increases your litter, your humus, organic matter content, that feeds the soil biology, that in turn then releases those nutrients you need in the soil itself. And you don't have to be dumping them on all the time. And there are other resources out there and really kind of exciting trends happening with, for instance, algae, where you can mix algae and water, very small doses of algae per tank to go spray. It's non-toxic. You can drink it if you wanted to. I mean, it's I think it'd be very fun to drink it, but it's not toxic. And then it feeds the soil. So you're actually, and you're increasing your chlorophyll, photosynthesis, and the results are coming back in, are pretty definitive that it's increasing plant growth as well as the nutrient value of the plant. It's more dense. And it is a substitute for your synthetic or anhydrous ammonia nitrogen sources, etc. And so this is not something that's kind of pie in the sky. This is simply chemistry and soil chemistry, and that's where the future is going. And so these tyrants keep cranking down on us. That's, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. They're going to eventually see their demise, and I think we're going to have a healthy food system in another 10 to 15 years once we get through this storm.
Yeah, I agree. And you sent me some great references on that. So we're going to include those references underneath this video as well. So if people want to look into that and, you know, better sources of for producing better soil, rather. Jim, did you have some follow-up questions?
Yeah, you know, as a matter of fact, I did. I noticed that when you talked about all the things that you had brought in, you had the water system and you the many, the various things, the garden. I noticed that you didn't bring cable TV in. I mean, I imagine, that is probably one of the, if you had to, for me, so I try to recommend people, that's what you need to do. I think you need to turn off the television and open a book and instead of watching television. What did you guys do for entertainment? Because, you know, you can't work 24/7. You got to be able to break away at some time and have entertainment. Did you go on hunting trips? Did you go to the swimming hole? Did you read? Did you have sit around the campfire and tell stories? What type of things did you do for recreation and entertainment if we get to the point where we're out of power, not electricity, we don't have television or radio or anything? What would you do in that situation?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's kind of why I anticipated. I look forward to what's coming to some degree, because I can, it kind of pulled me going back to where we were, because life was better. And we would sit there in the evening with, we had a longstanding rivalry in a checkers tournament. We played checkers, dominoes.
Great.
checkers. we would go swimming together. We go pick fruit together. We go drive. Well, there's so many activities, but then also at night, the funnest thing, the ironic thing was my granddad from Texas had given me all these old magazines that had been printed in Bandera, Texas in the 1930s, and there were interviews with the frontiersmen, and they're called Frontier Times. So I'd sit up at night by candlelight reading Frontier Times, and I'd start to say, hey, my wife, I said, hey, Kika, this is crazy. I mean, we're kind of living in a modern day frontier. We didn't know we had been parachuted into that. And then we started to piece it together by the stories and realized that we were in the middle of a modern day one. So we would read a lot. We would do what people used to do, and they had front porches and rocking chairs. We'd sit and talk with our employees, which is probably the funnest, because we would listen to their stories of how they got there, of the snake bites, of the battles, of the Indian fights with the Indians, which is kind of funny, because then I became friends with the Indians and I'd hear their version. And so I got to hear both sides of the story and became very That's close great. Friends with both sides, and realized that, you know, we're all humans. And, you know, ultimately, that's when you go back to the land, you kind of go back to the core of life is love. You love the land, you love people. And that we'd spend a lot of time. On weekends, I'd go in the forest with the employees who were really the woodsmen, and we'd go hunting. We'd go cruising through the forest looking for something to shoot, to eat, and also learning the different plants, medicinal plants. I did that with the Indians too. They taught me, shared with me. They're very gracious with their knowledge. So I think that's when we come back, when we get there, which we will. It's liberating, because you're going back to person-to-person contact and sharing life with other people versus behind a stupid cell phone or watching some idiot on television.
Agreed. So did your daughters, I mean, what a great experience for your daughters. Did they really like going there, and do they still go out there with you?
So, yeah, we're going to go down right now, this week. And my daughters... Yeah, it was very profound. It was very profound. They grew up in just a lifestyle that doesn't exist anymore. The biggest part of it was being exposed to people that the World Economic Forum and that idiot Harari would call the useless eaters. And those were our best friends. Those are the people that they say they want to help and they care about and all that. They're lying. And we had the real honor to be rubbing shoulders with people that went through tremendous hardship. And they were very gracious with themselves or food. They'd give you anything. They didn't have anything. They'd give you everything they had. And so my daughters were, oldest daughter, Katarina, her favorite thing to do in the morning, she'd get up and run to the cowboy's house to go eat their farofa, which is manioc flour mixed with fat, pig fat, and dried meat. And that was her breakfast every day. She would, she just absolutely loved it. And then my other daughter, 3 years old on horseback riding, had a horse accident. It flipped, rolled over on her, and then popped back up, and she was sitting there holding a saddle horn. And I looked at her, I said, well, I know what she's going to be when she grows up. And now she's about to go major in equine sciences in college, Texas Tech. So that's kind of funny. Wow. Yeah.
That's awesome.
It made those girls, it made them really, built a lot of character in them. I'm really proud of them.
I bet. I have one question that we didn't bring up, and I haven't actually talked with you about this. Do you collect rainwater?
I don't collect rainwater. And the only reason I don't is because I haven't gotten to it yet. And yeah. I've already started to research and to find a way to do it. Yeah, but we're going to do it on one of our sheds. I already have the storage tank for it. I just haven't put in the collection yet.
Gotcha. And you're on well, right? Or you have two wells, don't you?
Yeah, we have two wells.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing, Corey, just on the well, if there are deep wells, you need a big pump to pull the water up. But if you have a shallow well, you're using an old hand crank, those old timey cranks. And you can still get all this stuff, even like a tank, a pump that you can pump to pump fuel from a 50-gallon drum to a tractor. I have those things in my shop, expecting to use them someday. So you just, you want to make sure that you understand how to do it before it hits. So you have these contingencies already lined up on
right.
who, what, when, where, and why, when something happens, that you know what to do when something breaks or something goes down, that you don't panic, that you've already trained yourself on what needs to be done.
Right. I think that's one of the most important things too, is learning how to improvise and troubleshoot. And so, like you said, practicing with these different things before it actually becomes a necessity, and just learning to be more self-sufficient so that you are in the right state of mind and you're not worried when something happens,
Yeah.
Plans.
Just as a closing story, I flew to myself to the tribe about an hour away from us, and it was horrible weather, but I promised them I'd be there on a certain day, and I flew Napa the Earth, probably 50 feet above the canopy of Southern Amazon, and under pretty heavy rain, landed. And I was intending to spend one night, come back the next day back to our ranch. And anyway, that 100-foot ceiling dropped down to zero visibility as soon as I landed. And I ended up getting stuck there for about a week. And I had the clothes on my back, whatever. And I'd spent a lot of time with the Indians. Extended time, up to one time over almost 4 weeks straight. And so when you're living that environment, when you're totally in the middle of nowhere and you see how peaceful everybody is and how easy it is just to live. I mean, just to live.
Right.
You'll catch a fish in the morning and it might be all that you eat that day, but you're also not that hungry. Because you start to shrink your stomach. You don't need all that junk food. And so that's really the lesson or the message I've got is it's not hard, and it's just takes a little bit of planning, and it takes a community. That's the most important thing. The community is number one.
Right. I agree. Were you going to say something, Jim?
I was going to say something. What strikes me is what I would think would one of the revelations that you would have living that type of a life, though you did off grid like that, we're so wasteful here in America. We're so wasteful. We throw so much food away. I mean, tons of stuff. I would imagine when you live in the environment that you lived in, you learn to use all parts of the animal. You learn to use probably the bones to make tools, that type of thing. Is that the type of mentality? Is that the dichotomy that you see from living here in a modern, sort of a modern world, and then living in the sort of off-grid world, is you learn how to utilize things that maybe before you would have thrown out. Now they become useful and become tools and things you can use, in your environment. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's accurate. It's very accurate to the extent that even inventorying parts and stuff that you may need, your budget or even space didn't allow you the room to inventory X number of tires or whatever. So we would utilize, if we didn't eat it out of the garden, we would go give it to pigs or we'd feed it to the chickens. Everything was reusable. The cattle, we'd cure the own hide. We would take bark from a tree, a local tree there that had high in tannic acid, and we would tan our own hides. We would use the bones to make bone meal for the dogs to feed the, our guard dogs. And if you had to improvise, that's the fun thing. I had to flat on my plane one time. So you just don't have a spare. What do? Well, take it off, stuff it with grass, stuff it back on. It's full of grass, take off. So necessity is the mother of invention. There's a solution for everything. And that was the biggest lesson that I learned there was, being surrounded by people, most of them illiterate, but brilliant. They're brilliant. It never intimidated them getting a snake bite. What do you do with a snake bite? I could talk forever about stuff. There's always a solution. If there wasn't a solution, there's always a bottle of whiskey, a pinga. Make sure you have some whiskey on hand.
Yeah. That's modern world stuff too. That's modern world solutions as well there, not just Amazon.
Yeah, that's true.
Good stuff. I'm going through some of your photos while you're talking. This is fascinating. Some of the folks, some of the natives that you ran into. You were right there on ground, and you were right involved in the village and everything. There was no messing around.
Yeah, we would, when we became, we were adopted by this one tribe, called the Kamayada, who were dear friends of ours, and daughters spent a lot of time there too. And I would go off with my friends who, unfortunately, some of them have passed away the last 2 years, thanks to the folks across the pond in the COVID deal and also the getting the shots. But that ones that I was most close to passed away last year, but they were the hunters, and I'd go on hunting trips with them. And the first time I went, which was probably two decades ago, and I asked him what I needed. He said, nothing. I said, oh, how long are you going for? He goes, I don't know. And so off we went, and I was barefoot, and I thought we were going to go in on a trail for a while. He told me I didn't need my shoes. Well, here's Tenderfoot here. And after about 6 miles of going through the forest and realized that we weren't going back that day. And so got to lake, caught some fish, ate the fish, had an absolute ball. And that's really the confidence that gives you that surviving is really not that hard if you have some basic skills. Mm-hmm. You need a gun for sure. Guns, I would say smaller caliber versus bigger caliber 22s are probably a great option, because you can use them for small animals too, and it won't hurt the meat. But that's when you go there to the Indian and you really see that they have nothing on them other than some paint to keep the mosquitoes off. You don't need a lot of equipment. You don't need Bass Pro Shops and Cabela's and Walmart and all that crap. And you don't need all that crap that we have. The medications, our medical cabinet at the ranch had some aspirin, some Neosporin, alcohol. That's about it. It didn't last. The high humidity in the Amazon, I say it didn't last. Everything we had, we chunked because everything expired and got green. And so we made it. It's really not that big of a deal when you surround yourself with people that know. And there's plenty of people today that are all over the United States in cities that know, that are looking to build communities. And I think that's really the path forward. We better do it now while we have time before they crash everything. You know, the luck benefits the prepared. So if someone doesn't get prepared, well, shame on them.
What would you say for the, if you had to give three things people could do after they watch this video? Of course, you know, putting together a garden, it takes a period of time to do that. Not saying they can't start it, but what two or three things would you suggest people would be able to do right away that would get them ahead of the rest of the folks that are doing really nothing?
Well, I did it myself. So I'll just tell you what I did. I bought food. I bought freeze-dried food. And I've eaten a lot of freeze-dried food in my life, especially backpacking. So I went and bought enough freeze-dried food to at least have one meal a day, 2,000, 3,000 calories a day for my family that lasts for a month. And if I can't go get enough food in that month to carry me on after that, then I just deserve to rot away. I mean, it's not that hard. So if I have that comfort to know that I can, that luxury to have 30 days where I don't have to just scrounge, and then I have a water filter, I have I know where water is. If the pump goes down in the city and you don't have any water to your house or it's contaminated or whatever, where's the stream or where's the lake? And do I have a water container I can go get it? If you got the water and you got food and you got shelter, then you can relax. And then you can plan on and take baby steps on planting a small garden in a tiny area. 10 by 10, you can plant enough food that you could survive with a family of four, with the right techniques and the right methods. And there are methods out there like the middle lighter gardening method, which you can be a novice and immediately go online and do a class or go to one of their classes. I'm just using this as an example where immediately you're in the farming business, you're in the food business, and you can produce food easily with no experience, none. And so that's the thing I would do is food, water, and then the shelter. Everyone's got shelter. I say everyone, but most everyone doesn't have a problem with shelter. And then the third thing would be the community. Get my own food, my own water, and then surround myself with people that understand what's going on, that think alike, and that the last 2 years have been a great filter, but who's got their heads, you know, screwed on right, and who's out there in la-la land. I'm staying away from the la-la landers. I don't want to be around them anymore because it's dangerous. You need to be around folks that have principles and values and integrity.
And what would you say as far as, I know, you know, you help people out with livestock. Obviously, some people would be lucky to just have a chicken coop on their property because people live in apartments or townhomes or small areas, or they're stuck in an HOA that wouldn't allow that. But then there's people that do have a little bit of land and maybe they're thinking, well, I should get into having some livestock, and what animals should I start out with? You know, what do you think on that?
I think once again, keep it simple, stupid. Where are you going to get the most protein? And so if you had chickens and you have six chickens, you're going to have more eggs than you can eat. So that's your protein source, or eggs, number one.
Right.
And then you kind of go up from there. If you want to go in the rabbits and all that, I'm not real crazy about rabbits myself, so I don't, you know, but if you go into bigger livestock, sheep, goats, you can do that on a small homestead. And then once you get to a cow, a 1,000-pound cow, 1,100-pound cow, then you need a little bit more land. So I would say leave the beef aspect over to people that could trade with you for meat or sell you meat, and focus on what's going to produce protein for you the easiest. Chickens are simple. And whatever we produce, Corey, they've already got a plan how they're going to try to take it away from us. And that's
obvious. I know.
Yeah.
I know.
And I've already got a plan how I'm going to keep it. So, you know.
How about a goat for goat's milk? Is that something good?
I love goats, yes. Goat's my favorite because they eat anything. They're hardy. You don't need to have with good management, you don't have to really do anything to them. And then you have meat and also in the milk too. I love goats. Goat's my favorite. Cheaper, secondary to goat. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that and then hunting, of course, that's applies to us who live outside of the city. But, you know, I can assure you that that's what happened in the American South for 100 years, because there weren't any deer there as of 1980s. They'd kill everything after Reconstruction. So the people living in the rural South ate everything. They supplied their diet principally from wild animals. And that was the added necessity. So that we're going to head right back into that again. And so I would say that after about 5 years of this, there's not going to be a deer or an animal left except for the ones that got away and hid. So that's why I want a 22, so I need the small animals.
Mm. Mm-hmm. So you're heading out now in just a couple days, right? You're heading back to the Amazon for a while?
Yes, I'm going to go back in 2 days. I'll fly back and go back and do all of our ranch work. And it's a big family. It's a real homecoming. The Brazilian people are extraordinary. They've been under the boot heel of the tyrant forever. Living in Brazil is a blessing and also a warning of what's going to be coming to our country. It's already started. And I can see the signs of where we're headed. It's going, oh gosh, here we go. We're going to become I shouldn't say that. I don't mean it in a bad way, but we are going to become a Brazil soon, where the bureaucracy takes over, the corruption's so bad. Your supply chain's broken. You couldn't get parts, couldn't get anything. But the good side of that is that the black markets pop up. And so black markets pop up everywhere and you can trade. And they still do to this day. You still trade and barter. It's quite the training to go to Brazil to get prepared for, you know, this new world order crowd, Great Reset people.
Right. Right. But then you're going to stick around in Texas too though, right?
Yes. I mean, our two daughters are in college and they're in the United States. And so based on what I think is going to happen in the next few years, I want to be here just to be here for, to help my kids out. And then also in Brazil is kind of a refuge. Brazil's living out in the frontier. It's been a long time before someone gets out to those far reaches to try to come mess with you. So it's a great spot to run to, although I really don't like running. Texas is my home, and like I said, it's my home and it's my state. So I'm not going to mess with it. We'll try it and we'll regret it. But anyhow, yeah.
Well, we appreciate you spending time with us and giving people some tips on all of this.
Yeah, you're welcome. I'm honored to have been able to speak to you. And my last thought is, have a positive attitude, be grateful every day that we're alive, and realize that suffering and hardship builds character. And also it's a weeding out process. And unfortunately, I think a little bit of weeding out has to happen. But in that process, life becomes rich again. And, you know, my wife and I learned that in the Amazon, where violence was intense. There was a lot of evil. But on the flip side, there was so much good. And that's when people's true charity and the good side comes out and shines. And so that's about to happen. And the fact is, I think that's what we're talking for, is people are birds of a feather flocking together, and that means that we have a bright future, and eventually we will take control again.
I agree 100%.
John, if I could ask you, when you go to Brazil this time, would you be able to take some video, maybe as a follow-up, because I know we're going to put an article out for this, and maybe when you come back, I know how you'll be gone, but it sure would be nice to add some of the photos or videos on your trip that you got coming up in a couple of days. It'd be nice to add those into, if you even videotape me in there. I don't know if I'm asking you something out of school, but if you happen to do that, but I think we'd love to be able to get a hold of some of that stuff for our website or for this article.
Sure. Yeah, I'll be happy to. It'll be a lot of fun. I'll even kind of get some photos of what I was telling you, like these homesteads, and they show you each homestead. And it kind of takes the edge off, because you say, golly, that's truly, I mean, we built a homestead here about 3 years ago, and now it's so thick with plants you can't even see. It's got so much food, my employees don't know what to do with it. I'll do that. That's a great idea.
That's awesome. Awesome. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much, and definitely stay in touch if you're able to while you're there. Otherwise, we'll touch base when you get back.
You bet. Yeah. Thank you, Corey. Thank you, James.
We do appreciate you joining us today. We want to thank our guest for being here and wish him pray for his trip to Brazil. And for Corey Lynn, my co-host, this is James White. Until next time for the Solution Series, we'll see you next time.
So today is July 28th, 2022, and we're at the Rancho Jatobá in our kitchen in Mato Grosso, and there's Maria on the right and her sister Catarina next to her, stringing meat that we seasoned yesterday that we're going to smoke to make smoked jerky, and they're getting help from Dona Fátima. And then over here, the lady wearing all this stuff, that lady, yeah, she's the crazy one, Gigi. What kind of meat is it? É patinho, não? So what do you do? What do we do? We got the whole muscle, and then we cut it thin, and then seasoned it, and marinated it for overnight. And now you're stringing it. We got a little factory going with Dona Ginalva, Dona Fátima, Maria, and Catarina. And we smoke it for how long? Yeah. Yeah, no push. Maria. And Maria eat all of this in about half a day. I got the meat on the smoker. It's about a third of it. We'll smoke it like this for the next 24 hours. Okay, today's the 28th of July, 2022. 29th, yeah. And these are the girls that were little bitty, doing the same thing on the hostel's front steps when there was the old hostel here. And they had Longhorn shirts on. And they're making faces now. This place I bought from Dona Raimunda. And she was one of the original settlers here. So every time you go to a homestead like this, you'll see the same plants planted around everywhere that they were totally self-sufficient from vegetables, fruits, the manioc, everything, and including the cattle and the... Why are you smiling at me, making fun? Dona Ginalva, eu estou falando que aqui era Dona Raimunda. E aqui representa um posse típico da região, que em volta tem todas as plantas que a pessoa precisa para sobreviver. Verdade. Sim. É verdade. Aí, se você puder mostrar, a gente vai andar rapidinho, dar uma volta aqui sobre as plantas. Eu não conheço tudo, não. So we're going to walk around, we're going to go look at the plants, and then if you just look around this little small compound, it's got everything that a family would need on a year-round basis to survive. Water, food, all the fruits and vegetables, manioc, starch, and beef. So, we come in Mato Grosso at one of our cow camps and cowboy, that's Valde over there. This is a typical homestead. Everything you can see here supplies enough food for year round for a family. In this case, the family is six. So we'll start here. Is looks like a lime. And you got cashew tree, guayaba, guava, cashews. You can eat the nut, also the fruit. Cutting coconuts over there. There's a mango. There's another coconut. peppers, malagueta, oranges, another orange, mango. There's some baby mangoes coming out, be ready in November. More oranges and mangoes. The water well. Chickens, guinea fowl. Bananas. Sugar cane. Sows and piglets. More oranges. More bananas, three different varieties. We got a garden with vegetables, lettuce. It's a makeshift chicken house. It's our garden. Ginger, squash, arugula, lettuce, parsley, sugarcane in the back, berinjela. There's a passion fruit, maracuja. It's a banana rocha. It's a different variety. Takes about a year to produce. This is a banana masson, which is a tastes like an apple. Here's all the bananas here. More sugar cane in the back. And mixed in here are plants, medicinal plants that cure all types of ailments. I've been taking or drinking twice a day medicine made from a jatobá bark. Right there. Ahumol. There's the dug water well. Now I got an electric pump that pumps it up here. There's a tapir swimming across the lake. Massive.